Welcome back to another episode of the Consider the Dog podcast. Today, Evan Doggett will be joining us and we'll be discussing tips for helping easily distracted dogs to stay engaged with their owners, training plans for helping dogs who live together and have separation anxiety from each other, strategies for how to deal with severely reactive dogs when they explode in the moment, how to get your dog to stay for a lot longer than they do right now, and a whole lot more. This episode is absolutely packed with useful information, so let's get right into it. Just like our relationships with other humans in our lives, our relationships with our dogs are dynamic and complex. I believe that in order for those relationships to flourish, or to find resolution when those relationships become strained, we must attend to them thoughtfully and with care. Welcome to the Consider the Dog podcast, created from archived recordings of live sessions where our members get to ask their most burning questions to some of the greatest practitioners of canine behavior. I'm your host, Tyler Muto. I hope you enjoy this episode. And remember, if you want to join the conversation live, you can visit us at considerthedog.com.
We probably should have an intro song.
What would you choose, Ty?
Oh, like of an existing song? I thought you meant like, I mean, because you're such a good singer-songwriter.
Oh, I can just like grab the uke and make one right now on the spot if you want. But let's say a pre-recorded song. You can't say Foster Fail because that doesn't count. That would be brown nosing.
That's a song. I'm not. So I think something that you should know about me, that everybody listening should know about me, is I am not pop culture savvy. Like, I'm really bad. My wife thinks I'm ridiculous in a lot of ways, because I don't know who people are. I don't know. I just heard, I mean, like, no joke, I listened to a Macklemore song for the first time like 2 weeks ago. I knew who Macklemore was.
Okay.
But I couldn't tell you what any of his songs were. My wife was like, "You've never heard the song Thrift Store?" I'm like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." So she pulled it up on YouTube. It was an entertaining song.
Yeah.
I had never heard it before. I'm bad. I'm really
first
bad.
Time I heard that song, I was in university in the library with my headphones on, like, "Wow, this song is great," from my buddy. And he's like, "Look, I didn't have them connected." The entire library was just staring at me like,
"That's amazing." Yeah, that's amazing.
I learned my lesson.
Yeah. All right. Cool. I think we're good. Yeah, let's do this, man. We've got a lot of questions from Facebook, so we'll jump to those in between live questions from the stream.
Great.
Let me pull up my fancy document, courtesy of Jake, who's in the background. Y'all can say hi to
Jake. What's
up, Jake? Here too.
Jake's great. We love Jake.
We love Jake. Jake does all of our behind the scenes work. Okay. Okay. So, all right, I'm going to jump in right here. We got a question from San. You know, I never know if that's how you pronounce your name. And I think I've said that to you a few times. I've said your name, S-A-N-N-E. And I don't know if...
Sane.
Sane, is that it?
No, I have no idea.
I don't know. So I hope that now is the chance to correct me if I'm wrong. I hope that I haven't pronounced this poorly and you've just been too polite to tell me.
Do you know what I do on my page when I do a Q&A and I can't figure out the person's name? I just go with what is probably the least likely and then create an accent for that person. And then it's Sane from East Coast, California.
I could see it being Sane, but you know, the thing is I've done Zoom sessions with her.
Oh,
but I don't think there's not that much opportunity for you to say somebody's name back to them in a Zoom session. So it's just something I don't know. Anyhow, we'll get to the bottom of this. All right. How do you increase engagement with dogs that clearly check out with their owners because everything's more interesting than them? So she's seeing this with owners that are like begging their dogs for attention by constantly chattering and pushing food in their face and yada, yada, yada. So I think you answered some of your question right there. Like, let's get them to stop doing the things that maybe aren't helping, like constantly talking and pushing food in their face. So she's just saying she has a range of engagement games she uses, treat, chase, play, eye contact. But some dogs just don't think their owners are very fun. So do you have any go-to ways? Like, if you're trying to get a dog to dial in with the owner more, what's your favorite way to do that?
My favorite thing to tell people, and there's extremes of this, right? There's sometimes like the dog's just like not engaged because the environment is so distracting. And then there's dogs that are just like, I don't need you I don't need you at all. Like huskies, right? They often look at their owners and go like, on my own, I would be fine. And for those dogs, the really, really challenging dogs that just don't care, oftentimes it's enhanced because the person's like, oh my God, please love me. Please be that stereotypical golden or lab or whatever. That's just like, will endlessly be up your left nostril. So for the dogs that are just like completely checked out from their owners, I always tell everybody, dogs are the same as us. Everybody and everything wants what they can't have. So if you pull back to an extreme for a bit, if you're just like, hey, and don't solicit attention and don't try to engage and don't do any of those things, plus get them to work for their food, man, that dog is going to be totally different in a week. It might take a week. It's not going to happen in 5 minutes, but it's about changing the pattern. It's about seeing the pattern. The pattern right now is like trying to get your dog constantly love me, love me, love me. And the dog's just like, yeah. It's the same thing as high school. It's the same situation. The ones that are like, look at me, are the ones that often don't get the attention. So
I think that's great advice, you know, and I think that speaks a little bit to what was mentioned about like the owners constantly chattering and whatnot. And that's obviously a big thing, you know, for me too. I guess the one thing that I want to mention with this topic. So I like engagement games, you know, the food chasing, you know, those kinds of things. I think that's great. It's great to play with the dog and show the dog that you're fun and that you're interesting. But this is also something that comes up in the context of when we train deaf dogs. And one of our things when we train deaf dogs is we love to use the remote collar because we really like to use the vibrate feature as sort of our way to get the dog's attention. So we use stimulation normally as our sort of motivational thing, but we like to use the vibrate more of a cue. And I always tell people, you know, you want the vibrate that the dog then knows to look to you so you can give your hand signals. So even if we weren't going to use like negative reinforcement in our training, we still want the value of having that vibrate, the ability to reach out and get your dog's attention at a distance for a deaf dog is insanely valuable. Like it opens up worlds of ability between you and the dog. And historically, the way that I first was taught to do this and the way I know a lot of trainers do this is we teach the vibrate as like a look at me cue, right? And there's a few ways that people would do that. They could just do like the vibrate food, vibrate food, vibrate food, vibrate food. And then it's like, oh, vibrate means you're going to have food. Of course, then sometimes people do other methods of teaching, look at me, like, you know, make eye contact, like holding food in your hands and holding it out and waiting for the dog to kind of look in the middle. But one thing that I have found to be sort of most important and allow us to sort of get the message that we need, even if a dog's not necessarily food motivated, is if we want a cue to mean, hey, the next piece of information from me, or there's a piece of information that's going to be coming from me that might be useful to you, then let's just sort of make it all about that, right? Like as we're going through teaching the dog, anytime that the next thing we're going to do is going to be important or useful or lead to some other opportunity for consequences, such as treats or avoiding something uncomfortable or whatever, that we just precede it with the vibrate. And the dog starts to go, okay, every time I feel the vibrate, the next thing that happens is something I want to pay attention to. It's something that's going to be meaningful to me. Right. And so, and this kind of goes along with what you're saying, but when we talk about getting a dog to pay attention to their owner, yes, we want the owner to be interesting, but the reality is when we're talking about just real world living with dogs, we aren't always going to be the most interesting thing. And we don't always have the ability to like stop what we're doing and start running around playing with the dog because it's so important that we are more interesting than the environment. Sometimes we need to be the boring thing in the environment and we still just need the dog to stay aware of us. And so along with cutting out some of the useless information, you know, again, people and dogs are very similar. So when we tell people like, don't do this, sometimes you get a little bit of resistance, like consciously or not. But if we say, hey,
it's
what I want to focus
it's the
on
hardest thing you can ask them to do.
Yeah. But if we say, you know, what we need to do here is make sure that the only things that come out of our mouth are important and useful pieces of information. So we want to think about like how pragmatic is this thing that I'm doing right now for the dog? Does it help the dog in any way, this noise that I'm making? And so let's focus on what are the ways that we can communicate with a dog where the dog goes, hey, when I hear your voice, it's usually something that's important to me. It's usually something that's going to have an impact on my well-being, my welfare, whether I get something that I want, right? So let's just start making sure that we use our voice in useful ways. And if when you're out in the world, you find ways to show the dog that you are a source of valuable information, you'll have a dog that even when they are distracted, they keep one ear, you know, sort of tuned in for your voice, or they check in with you visually because you've made yourself important to them, right? Not because you're more fun, but because you possess valuable information that can affect them, you know? So it's just sort of like a different, I guess, take on it.
But one again,
it doesn't mean you can't also do engagement games. It doesn't mean that, you know, any of that other stuff isn't valuable at all, but we do want to make sure that we are the source of pragmatic knowledge, right?
Yeah. I think one of the aspects that we always need to ask our clients is like, you know, and get to the root and ask like, legit, like why does it matter so much right now in this context that your dog is giving you their undivided attention? Sometimes it's really important and other times it's not. We need to let them, you know, explore and live life. The thing that I'm thinking of is when I did Rodney Habib and Dr. Karen Becker's thing, we were talking afterwards, their podcast, and they were saying that the number one Googled question for the past 2 years has been, is my dog happy? / how do I make my dog happier? It had to equate with dog and happy. So I think a lot of times people feel like if my dog isn't connecting with me, they're not happy, but really we're, you know, personifying our happiness and our engagement and, you know, the importance of that there. So we have to ask ourselves, like, why does it matter so much right now? And the other thing with clients is helping your client understand that it's okay that your dog is who they are. They were all born with a personality. They were all born with certain character traits that are them, right? Like we all have a personality. Regardless, you got 12 puppies in a litter, all the exact same genetic makeup, but they're all individually different. And some people get, like, I've got a client right now that has this young husky, and they really wanted that dog that was going to like just beg for their attention all the time, and the dog doesn't care. And I've told them many times, like, you need to understand this is who he is. So you can have fun together, but it's not going to be curling up on the couch. Like he just doesn't want it at his core. So you can do all of this really hard thing for you of ignoring him and doing engagement games. But at the end of the day, he just doesn't want it. Right. And we need to accept that. And that's very, very challenging for anybody, especially when you have expectations.
And I think, of course, like context matters too. Like obviously, you know, if you're in a group class with your dog, like you want your dog at least for that duration of time to be somewhat engaged with you, because otherwise you're just not going to get anything out of the class.
Yeah,
or 100%. If you're trying to train your dog for, you know, a show or competition of some sort or a sport, then there's a certain degree of engagement that's kind of required for that. But, you know, when we're just talking about like living life with dogs, I think that's sort of the key for me. And so it's probably less about what do I do right now in this moment? Like if I'm, you know, I'm with my dog, I'm at a group class, I'm struggling. And if the trainer were to say to me some of the things that we just talked about, like maybe stop all the excess, you know, chatter, maybe stop trying to shove food in your dog's face, make these things a little bit, you know, create scarcity essentially. And, you know, let's make sure that you are learning how to give communication that the dog actually sees as meaningful, because that's a huge part of it. People don't know how to communicate to their dogs. Then it's less about what do I do right now in this moment? And it's about taking all that information to heart and at home, putting that into play over
that's
the
long term.
Days.
It's a long term play. Yeah.
And your dog starts to see, hey, wait a minute, things have changed, right? Because if your dog perceives you as sort of lacking value to them for any of the reasons that we discussed, that's not going to change in a minute. You know what I mean? Like it has to do with who your dog thinks you are in relation to them, in relation to the environment. And the dog, you know, even if you were to do perfect for 5 minutes, the dog's going to probably be like, yeah, but like, I know who you really are. And you got to show them that the change is here to last. Right.
Yeah.
So
next question.
It's a good question. It's a good question. Yeah.
But we could go on for an hour on that one.
Christina, and this is coming from the stream here. So Christina wants to know about separation distress between dogs. So an 8-year-old dog and a 2-year-old dog. And the 2-year-old dog was raised with the 8-year-old dog and gets super stressed when separated. So I'm guessing it's the 2-year. I think that means the 2-year-old dog's getting distressed when the 8-year-old dog goes away. This happens all the time. Thoughts?
It's normal. Just first of all, they're pack animals. Like, I think everybody thinks it's very abnormal that your dog has any sort of separation anxiety with you or with their dog or with another dog. And it's often stronger with other dogs because they're so used to that. I'm a big fan of obviously training for this. I take my dogs out individually. I have individual time. And if you have family and friends to help you out with this, you make the time that the 2-year-old is engaging, very engaging to begin with, and then taper off that engagement. But that engagement doesn't have to necessarily be with another person. Obviously, if another person is there, you're going to have less. Obviously, if you're not crate training, you're going to have less destruction. You're going to have it supervised anyway. But great time to pull out a big meaty bone. But you know, if there's just meaty bones all over the place, if there's toys all over the place, if there's just everything all over the place, free access all the time, obviously the dog is going to, there's no motivation there. If I just have a stack of gold bars, what's the incentive, right? To go out and do the next thing. If I'm the tricky thing with comparing money, using money as an analogy with people, is we always want more. So that doesn't work as much, but having, you know, something very valuable, like a bone or someone being there initially, and then just tapering that off to where it's not as intense. And then obviously your duration and distance from the dog doing it incrementally will help over time. And ultimately it comes down to consistency. How often are you doing this? Timing, consistency, and motivation are a great 3 key pillar there to keep in mind. So what do you think, Ty?
Yeah. I mean, I think you pretty much nailed it. I mean, the big thing, like you said, is being prepared for it. You know, my friend Chad Mackin, who's also a very talented dog trainer, he used to say, he probably still does say it, normal is what you're used to. And so even though, like you mentioned, this is a very normal thing, dogs are pack animals, it's not crazy for them to be a little distressed when their, you know, family members leave. Yeah. What they're telling you is that for them, this doesn't feel normal. Like this feels different. And so probably we haven't done enough of what you're talking about, enough of kind of preparing the dogs for this. And so just like, I think anything else, just that sort of incremental exposure, you know, that's kind of the thing. Like, let's just separate for short periods, give the dog a bone, you know, play with them. Yeah. I think you covered it, man.
I think crating inside the home while, you know, having one dog in and one dog out, everybody's always so concerned about it being fair. Life's not fair, right? You know, they don't care about fairness in terms of like, if I'm still hungry, you're not getting this. Like, once I'm done with the bone, then maybe you can have it, or maybe I'll pick it up and take it away and bury it just so that you don't get it, right? Like, the life's not fair, and we're constantly concerned. Like, when I take a new dog into my house, there are rules for that dog that the other dogs don't have. Because I'm not always raising puppies. Like, my last dog is like 6 or something. And if she, like, she's allowed out right now, and I think the other one's locked away. I don't know, because I do it so randomly that they don't know when it's coming, right?
Yeah.
I might feed one and I might fast one the other day. And people are like, oh, that's terrible. That's the cruelest thing. But I keep my dogs on their toes, and they don't get into this pattern of every day at 4 p.m. we eat. And then, because, you know, at 4 p.m., oh, I'm stuck in traffic and they're puking up bile because their body went produce bile right now. So consistently inconsistent is a thing too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably the biggest thing. I want to switch gears here. So we got a nice question here from our medic. Our medic. Okay. What are your favorite tips for dealing with extreme leash reactivity in the moment? And I like this question because there's obviously like oh, how would we go about solving this problem, like big picture, long term? But like, yeah, we're in this moment.
Just get even to the meat potatoes, dog trainer, boys. Don't give us theory all day. I mean,
you could be the best dog trainer in the world, but every now and then, whoops, and the dog loses its mind, and there you are.
Yeah.
So what do you do in that moment when the dog's losing its mind? How do you handle that? There's so many ways you could answer this question.
I'm a big fan of movement is probably my first answer. Movement and applying pressure that works for the dog. And so that might mean, like, you know, some dogs like will overstimulate when you apply a certain kind of pressure, like prong collar, like slip lead, like air, like water, like touch, any of those things can create, if you poke the bear, it can be worse, but there's always going to be something that can break the focus. It's what is the type of thing. But I'm not a fan of getting the dog to, you know, sit and holding on and don't move and, you know, holding on to the collar. It's the last thing that I want to do. One of my favorite things is to create movement by going forward and backwards, keeping my head up so I'm still being aware. If you're doing this to your dog and your dog's being reactive, do you notice the other dog coming right up on you? Right. But ultimately, what I try to communicate is don't do that. Let's keep going.
Yeah. I think, one thought that came to mind for me was one thing I generally don't do. So, in these moments of like, whoops, unless I know that I have some form of correction that can really interrupt that behavior effectively and sort of get the dog to at least give me that window where I've got the dog's focus for a moment. One thing that I'm not going to do is just, unless it's part of my plan, I'm not going to just start trying to like correct the dog and get him to stop. Like, let's say it is my first time out with a dog and for whatever reason the dog blows up. And for whatever reason I go, I'm going to try to give a leash pop. This dog's got a prong collar on. I'm going to leash pop it and see if that can snap the dog out of it. And it doesn't. And maybe even the dog escalates a little bit. One thing I'm definitely not going to do is like keep leash popping the dog. Right? Like, I'm not going to keep doing that. Yeah. But it's really worth mentioning because I see this all the time when I'm out walking my dogs. People's dogs are reactive. It's you can, as a professional, you can make a living just dealing with leash reactivity. Like, it's so common.
We all do.
And exactly. Yeah. And and people are, you know, they're saying no and they're yanking on their dog and they're trying, and it's not working. Usually they just have the dog on a flat collar or sometimes even a harness, but it's just not working. And so let's say that I can't interrupt the dog. I don't yet have that skill set, or I haven't yet figured out what kind of pressure, what kind of correction can actually sort of cut through the noise. Yeah. Or maybe it's just one of those dogs that once they pop, like, you're not cutting through it.
Yeah.
Because those dogs exist too.
Yeah.
Then for me, it's like, let's just get out of here. Like, yeah, how do I get out of the situation? Yeah, yeah. Right? Yeah. Like, that's my go-to.
Keep going.
And keep going, turn around, go the other way. I don't care. Yep. I'm going to choose my battles here. I'm going to recognize that, like, whoops, I lost this one. Let me learn from it and say, how can I maybe do better or try to avoid this situation again? But one thing that came to my mind was, it was a few times ago that you were on the stream with me that you showed a leash handling exercise. You did it with your stool. And it was like showing people how to like give room on the leash, but then also like slide in and get their hand nice and close to the dog. You can do it. Give me a minute though.
Yeah.
Because what we want to be able to do is, if the dog's losing their mind, and assuming this isn't the dog that's maybe really prone to redirecting or coming up the leash, like, let me get close to the dog and get some control. And that way I can get the dog out of there. If you're on the end of a 6-foot leash and your dog's on the other end, sometimes it could be really hard even to just like hightail it out of there. The more the dog can move around on the leash, the more leverage they have, more momentum they can get. So we want to get close, we want to get control, and then we want to just get the heck out. So yeah, maybe you can show your stool thing, because I think that's useful.
So the point of the leash thing here is, if I don't know a dog, I don't want that dog. Here's the thing: is most dogs, and you know, it's always so hard to generalize, but it's important to understand, okay, in this situation, you might do this, and in that situation, you might do this. I found that, and I think a lot of people would agree that the more you choke up on the leash, the more you like get around the dog and really try to hold on to them, the more explosive they can become. So, you know, the number one thing for me is movement. And so I find one of the techniques, and again, here's the beautiful thing about dog training, guys, is like Tyler said, don't be married to one idea, right? Don't be married to like the leash pop will work. Like it's okay to abandon that immediate plan that you came up with and just get the hell out of there. And I think it's very embarrassing for a lot of dog trainers when they're like, I should be able to fix this immediately. No, this might take a few weeks, right? Like it might take a couple of lessons and it might take a few weeks and it might, you know, there are some dogs that are like big projects. And so it's okay. Don't be embarrassed. It's just admit it. One of the trainers that I coach, we repeated every session multiple times a session for multiple weeks, maybe even months. I don't know. And that's okay. So when a client says like, what do we do right now? Oh my God, I don't know. We're going to try all these things, but I don't know what's going to work. I have no idea what the end result is going to be perfectly for your dog, but we're going to get there. We're going to keep trying because there's so many different things that we can do in these situations. I don't know. That's okay. Right? Like we'll keep working on it. So as a dog trainer, be aware that like, I think that's why it's important to work with other people to go to take little tidbits. I've been to seminars and traveled across the country to be like, whew, well, I'm not doing any of that other than that one little thing. And that was great, you know, and that was great. And I've used that technique. But the leash thing is when your dog goes, a lot of people hold their leash like this, right? So you've got one hand here and you've got another hand here. And with one hand, you're not very strong, but two hands together at the center of your mass, you're much stronger, right? You can control, you can hold your dog, but your dog is going to be way out there, right? So the problem with that is that if the dog comes back or can be doing this, right? As opposed to here, well, they only have a foot and keep going. So it's not to say that you're going to do one or the other 100% of the time. It's about knowing both things. So dog goes out, you start to lose control. Rather than trying to fight it with one hand, you slide up, step back, ask the dog to come, guide back to your left, and go forward. Now, this isn't something you practice every time the dog gets reactive. You practice this when the dog isn't reactive, simply by putting the leash on the dog and doing food over to this side and go forward again. Come backwards, over, and keep going again.
Cool. Yeah, just a little follow-up. He or she said, thanks, guys. This is a client's dog, and the client wants his leash reactivity to be solved by end of June. Face palm. She's been doing this kind of movement, keeping to ourselves a distance to stay below threshold and work on counter conditioning. So, yeah, I mean, you know, realistically, I don't think end of June is like that crazy of a goal to at least have some significant progress. I think if you're trying to do it with just counter conditioning, then it can be a lengthy process. But I think if you get the right sort of combination of techniques, you should be able to make some headway, you know, but I think it's different. Like I'm not trying to, so in the moments when the dog loses its mind, that's not when I'm trying to solve the problem. That's when I'm trying to do crisis control. You know what I mean? So there's a major difference between what do I do to solve solve leash reactivity and what do I do when that dog explodes into a reactive terror? Those are very different things. The first is my plan to fix the problem. The second is just crisis control in a moment. And that can really have nothing to do with my plan to fix the problem in a lot of cases.
Mitigate your losses.
Exactly. Right. Learn from the experience, get the heck out of there. Cause the whole goal, I mean, if you're going to do it well, the goal is to not let the dog get that far gone. Mm-hmm. You know,
hey listeners, just a quick reminder. These podcasts are created from archived recordings of live sessions where members of our community can ask questions and interact with our instructors in real time. If you'd like to be part of the discussion, visit considerthedog.com and use code CTDPODCAST to get 50% off your first 3 months. That's 3 months for $10 a month, and you have access to not only these live sessions, but also our library of hundreds of exclusive videos and courses on dog behavior. Again, visit considerthedog.com and use code CTDPODCAST. Let's get back to the show.
Okay, now question here from, we'll go back into like some easier not easier necessarily for everybody, but like not aggression for a moment here.
Yeah.
So I think this is, it's either Callie or Kaylee. Adopted a rescue German shepherd, but no obedience. She's been teaching him to sit with treats and body language. He responded to treats initially, but now gets up right after he receives the treat. What do we do? What's the next step? Right? Because we keep him in the sit. We can get the dog in the sit. How do we keep him in the sit after he gets the treat?
Yeah. So a lot of times it's just, we do this with our dogs. I don't have any food, but she might wake up. So this is Vega. This is my German shepherd. Yeah.
You saw the pose.
Every time she heard my foot do this. So you get your dog into a sit, and a lot of people go, "Good dog." And the dog, and well, I mean, she's pretty good, but they would normally she'll do it because I'm intentionally like only putting a little bit of time into her, so that way she's still wild during my online lessons. So if I get her into a sit and then come sit. So a dog like this, obviously she's like, nope, don't want it right now. Re-engage. She knows I don't have anything and I don't have any tools on her. This is where I might abandon the engagement with her, which obviously isn't the question right now. So I'm not going to work with her, or I would go and get something, or I would go and put a leash on this dog, right? Because otherwise you're just going to keep getting frustrated. But normal, right? You don't put the time into them, they're not going to do the thing. So for me, it's now rather than feeding right away for the behavior, you got a couple options here. You can roll back, come in, feed, mark, good job, feed, good job. Now, if the dog breaks the thing, obviously having a leash on the dog makes a world of difference. They can't just get up and walk away. Having a leash on the dog, guiding with some pressure, sit, good, and then creating that distance. So you're leaving, coming back, leaving again, coming back, feeding, and then having a release command, break, and the dog's allowed to leave, and you can feed or play on break as well.
Cool. So full disclosure, I'm sitting here going, he's going to ask me what my thoughts are on this, and I was not paying attention to anything you were saying because I was reading
the next comment.
I was reading the next questions. I was trying to be prepared.
So I answered it perfectly. So just go on to the next question.
That sounds great. You may have said this, but you mentioned something earlier. You said to be predictably unpredictable. And I think that applies here as well. Like when you're given those follow-up treats, you know, after that first treat, right? If it's always like one treat comes and then the next treat doesn't come for 2 minutes, you know, the dog can start to, I got 2 minutes to get up and goof off. And then, you know, anyway,
I think the secret to all of it is don't train with treats, train with food, especially if the dog's kibble fed. You know, if the thing that you want to work on, if that's how they're eating, like if I want my dog to be really good at sits, that's how they're going to eat. It's a great technique, right? That way they're that's what they're consuming. That's what they're living for, the sit, you know, works really well.
Or they're sitting to live. Okay. Let's jump. You know, I want to go back to some of the questions here that came in on the Facebook thread over the past couple of days. There's a good one here from Andy, and he's asking about a new rescue dog that doesn't have any obedience training. And she's high energy. And so he's wondering about structure, like, you know, the dog doesn't have any training. Should he like go right into like loose leash walking and all that kind of thing, or give her some long line and let her just burn off energy to, you know, how strict are you when you bring a new dog in where you want to start? Like, this is the routine. This is the structure. You've got to learn self-control. Or do we say, hey, like, let's let you just
decompress,
get yourself settled, you know?
Yeah. I think that's the biggest mistake people can make is, just do whatever you want. Just be on vacation for the first couple of weeks. Like if you are an employer and you let someone come in and go, you know what, for the next 2 weeks, just do whatever you want. Like, no, because you're setting the stage for that. There always is the decompression phase. But as someone, I work with a lot of rescues. I, you know, go to Mexico and do these spay neuter clinics and all this other stuff. And the number one problem that I see often is this honeymoon phase where the dog comes in, the people feel terrible because, oh my God, she's a street dog, whatever, poor her. She's got, you know, scars on her face because she's, you know, been in fights and things like that. And we put all of this, you know, sob story on the dog, but the dog's just like, hey, I'm here. I'm in Canada. Let's play. Let's do things. So I'm a big fan of getting the dogs to work for their food right away. It's the basis of how I work with dogs. And I go like I was saying before, where it doesn't have to be fair. Just because she's allowed on the couch doesn't mean you are. You're new here. I don't know if you're going to start guarding the couch and being protective of those things. So whether it's a short leash, whether it's a long leash, it's that whole engagement thing, getting them to go, hey, when I talk to you, it matters. It's going to lead to something, right? Either something you want, or it's going to cue for something to avoid something that you don't want. Pay attention to me. I matter. And then you get a really great dog, and their personality is going to come out anyway. It's just, we don't want the Cujo side of their behavior to come out because they're like, nobody's in charge here. I'm taking over. This is great. Some of those dogs will never do that. And a lot of dogs will.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's so much easier to go from like tight rules to like, okay, you've earned privileges and I can loosen the rules, than it is to go the other way. Like, I mean, that's kind of the moral of the story. And I think too, like when we talk about decompression doesn't have to mean free for all. I mean, I do think it can be valuable. You know, when you, like, I've had dogs that come out of the shelter and it takes a few days before they're like totally de-stressed, right? I mean, some shelters, depending where the dog came from, can be really stressful environments. If the dog was in a foster home, maybe not as much, but even, you know, changing locations, new family, new house, everything's different. That's stressful. But decompression doesn't have to mean total free for all. And in fact, for me, decompression would mean, even if I'm not going to do a lot of stuff with you, like I'm not going to start training a lot, I'm also not going to be giving you like full reign of the house, right? So
the opposite, you know, really.
Yeah. So it, instead of like, hey, let's let you get comfortable with this whole house, it's like, no, how about you just get comfortable like with this room, and we'll go out for walks, and I'll bring you into the rest of the house like on leash and staying by my side, and you know, you don't have to wander around freely right now. Like, you're gonna just do this sort of thing, right? And I may not be expecting the dog to learn, you know, sit down, stay loose leash walking, but that also doesn't necessarily mean the dog can just run around and do whatever like want. You said, you know, there's no charge here. We don't kind of want that. We want to just, at least you can low structure, but then also low freedom, you know, with discipline comes freedom. That's part of the exchange, right?
Yeah. The best thing is, especially if you're working with rescues, is that's why a crate is so important, and why with new fosters and new adopters, that is the dog's safe place, right? So they can, when you want to decompress, it's really your body needs to sleep, and dogs need way more sleep than we do because they don't go into the same REM cycle that we do. So we charge our batteries relatively quickly compared to them. They don't hit the same level of REM. So that's why they're napping constantly. And so if the dog knows, hey, at least I'm like good in this crate, it really, really, really helps with transition. And trying to convince a new foster or a new adopter, I mean, if you're in the position where you go, there's no convincing involved, these are the rules, that the dog sleeps in the crate, they're napping in their crate, they're spending that time, the dog will be able to decompress in a way that is natural to them. Den it up.
Yep. Okay. All right. Let me see here. There's a few new questions that came in. I wanted to jump into another one from the Facebook thread, but let me just take a look at what just came in here really quick. Give me a second. Evan, dance. No, just kidding. Also, one of my dogs just farted, and it is awful. I am like, if my eyes start watering, it's like, I'm not joking. I think there's a window cracked right here. I've got three windows open. I'm dying over here. It's really horrific.
Get the healthy gut from adored beast. That'll help.
Okay. There's actually a few questions here I want to get to. We probably won't get to them all, but there's one interesting one that I do want to get to that came in on the Facebook group. And it's a super long post. I'm going to try to condense it. So this one's from Lori, and it sounds like she's a dog walker, does like pack style walks. And cool. She's got a dog that they were out and about in public, and she was trying to get the dog to do a downstay or do a down, and was using a bit of leash pressure. And in her opinion, she used too much, and then the dog just kind of went into submission mode, like started shaking and then like did eventually go down and like showed belly and all this kind of stuff. Owners say the dog can be super headstrong at times, but obviously this seemed sort of like a, you know, over the top sort of reaction. And so Lori's, you know, in that moment, Lori's going,
shit.
Good girl, belly rubs, like try to get her out of that. And then like, is that the wrong thing to do? And like, what does this mean? Like, did I go too fast for the dog where the dog just wasn't ready for that kind of thing? Was it just a matter of too much pressure? Was the dog being headstrong? What does it all mean? What does it all mean?
I think like you guys, everyone but Tyler saw me just a minute ago not be able to get my own dog to sit. Did you see that or no? Were you?
I did not see that. No.
So she's watching the playback. I'm like, sit. And she's like, you don't have anything. I'm like, let's try again. Let's do a little, come on now. We're live on camera. At some point it's like, how much does this matter? Right. Like, and that's what I talked about is like, you can just get up and go away. But when you find yourself in a situation where this is a thing that I try to communicate to dog trainers so often is like, don't let your ego mess with you. Where it like, whether the dog does it perfectly is not a reflection of how good of a trainer you are. I think the value of how good of a trainer you are is how well can you communicate how to best set up this dog and communicate that to the people. Right. I think that's like the more important side of training dogs is easy. It's just repetition and motivation, right? It's like, it's really not that complicated of a science. We try to make it complicated so you guys keep coming back and think we're more important than we are, but it's not that difficult. So if you find yourself in a situation where you're like, I need to do this, just stop for a second and go, but do I? And the answer might be yes. The answer might be very much you need to do this thing right now. And you end up using pressure to motivate. And then you go, oh, it was a little too much. And we kind of rushed the situation. We probably could have done more reps, but you're already there. You're already at that point where you're like, I used too much pressure. Depending on the dog. Yeah. You might be like, hey, come on, let's bounce around and let's play. And that might boom, snap the dog right out of it. And sometimes you need to just be like, ah, shit, sorry about that. Okay, let's go. And create movement. There's nothing better for the dog to break the funk. And you'll see they get walking and then what do? They do a big shake and then it's over for the most part. You might come back to the same situation in the same environment where you're like the dog in that situation, in that environment the next time. Now we just know I got to work on it, right? That I got to go back and I need to create more motivation in that situation. But I think playing with the dog is okay. I think also understanding that like sometimes trying to play with the dog is only going to stress the dog out more. Like, oh, what do they want from me now? Oh, I don't want to do it. So it's needy time. Take it down. So yeah, she was just communicating that. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, you know, for better or worse, like I think we have to understand that even, you know, whether you're just out there with your own personal dog, whether you're a dog walker, whether you're a professional trainer, every now and then you're going to do something and go, ah, maybe that wasn't the best thing in the moment. And I think to me, like that's the kind of the more important thing is just that we recognize that way more important than like, you know, oh, I tried to help the dog by giving belly rubs. Was that wrong? Or I baby talked, or I, you know, tried to give her treats. Like, I don't think, I mean,
like, yes, I mean, she's coming here with the question. I mean, right? Like,
but yeah, like, exactly. I think the big thing is just like we recognized oops. And then we just go, well, how can we maybe do better next time? You know, what can I try? I don't really want to just do that same thing again. So what's maybe a different way that I could approach this problem? Whether that is, you know, like she mentioned that the dog can down like in a quiet, you know, in a more like yeah, out in the woods in a quiet area. This was, I forgot what she said this was. It was a distracting setting though. And yes, maybe you need to like gradually work up to that level of distraction. Maybe the dog needs more work on understanding leash pressure, especially downward leash pressure. That's one, you know, for those of you guys that are like newer to dog handling, you know, it's one thing to move a dog side to side or forward, backward, but getting them to lay down with leash pressure is probably the hardest of all the sort of directional things, aside from like getting them to walk straight backwards. Like if you put them between yourself and a wall, that can be difficult for some dogs too, but down is tough. And especially if it's a challenging scenario and they feel unsure and uncertain, laying down could be a vulnerable position for them. And so if they feel like they're being sort of forced into that, you know, is this sort of part of your plan? I mean, you know, like every dog trainer is different, whether or not I agree with it. There are some dog trainers that are like, no, I just teach dogs that dog mean, you know, that like down means down. So I say it and wham, and like, they'll get over it. I'll do it 400 times and then they'll be fine. And like, you know, I may not agree with that, but if that's part of your plan, I guess that's part of your plan. But like, obviously for Lori, it doesn't sound like it was part of her plan. And so for me, anytime I do something,
it's a technique it's not, that you like, saw and tried and.
Yeah. And like that didn't work the way I expected it to. Then that's really useful information. And then it's just a matter of trial and error. Cause like you said, Evan, sometimes we just don't know. We just don't know. And we just have to say, okay, well, that one didn't work. What can I try different? What are my options here? What are the high probability options? You know, or like maybe because this dog got really stressed, I want to err on the side of playing it safer. So I want to weigh my options, say, okay, what's one that might be helpful, but also has a really low chance of accidentally stressing the dog again? You know, where's that in between kind of point? So I think that's, you know, all those things can be helpful. But I think the big thing here is just like recognizing I didn't like the way that went. What can I
learn? That was good. And I mean, good on you for coming here and being like, hey, I fucked up, you know, like good for you. That's not an easy thing to do. So
yeah,
good job. Well done. We've all been there. We've all done that.
Yes. Too many times. Right. And you know, like I always tell people, you know,
number three.
I do so much, I do so much coaching with other professionals, and I know you do a lot of this, Evan, too. And like, one of the biggest kind of consistent themes that always comes across is this idea of like imposter syndrome, right? This idea of I must not be good enough, or this must mean that I'm some kind of failure in some way. And like the bad news is like that doesn't ever stop. Like that, it doesn't matter. So whether this is just you out with your personal dog and you made a mistake, or you're a professional that's, you know, a novice and you made a mistake, just know that like, even for myself, and I'm sure for you, Evan, there are days where I'm like, man, I feel like I have no idea what I'm doing right now, you know? And then I still feel like I'm missing some key piece. Right. And that just, that really never goes away.
Just keep trying,
Just, you know, think outside the box and say,
keep showing up to the live Q&As, keep asking questions. You're on the right track.
Yeah. Okay. Here's one that can be sort of interesting. So, this comes from, I believe it's GKC, still confused about how a lot of trainers are using a release command. So this person always thought the release was go be a dog at ease, but then Evan says to use treats or play after you break them. How do we reconcile those two things of like break, go do whatever versus break, let's play?
I think it's context for the dog. I know people use different things. Like I use a different one when I want my dogs to go say hi to another dog. Like if I'm going to let them do that, I'll just say, go say hi.
But did your dog get into your bondage equipment? What's happening?
He's trying it on for size. He's the same size as Mo.
Keep your closet door closed.
This is the most important. As your dogs get older, especially with a giant dog, or they make them even smaller, I would not have this. We would have had to put him down if it wasn't for this harness. It's called a help him up harness. Yep. And it's fantastic. So I can lift this 130-pound dog like a suitcase.
And they've got a shoulder strap for him too, which is awesome. You can literally wear him like like a shoulder bag. I have one of those harnesses. I had it for my older dog who's no longer with us, but I recently gave it to my parents to use. They just recently had to put their dog down too. But again, towards the end, he couldn't go up and down stairs and stuff. Those harnesses are amazing. They really are great.
When I would leave my, like I could carry him up and down, but it can be on nice and loose so he can have it on for like the whole day or, you know, depending on how loose, longer. But yeah, really, really, really great. And you can also take it to the bedroom. Terrible. You're terrible.
Back to the, what was the question? Release cue. the release queue.
Yeah. So I think for me, it's a context. It's like, do I have food in my hand and break? And then once you're done eating, are you done? Okay. Or is it to a bite, or is it to go and play? But a lot of times where I play like run and attack and bite the sleeve on the word break, I don't say that to my dogs when they're going to go meet another dog. I don't go like high octane word. Go say hi, be nice, go say hi, and be really chill about it. And then if I'm out in a field and I go and we're walking and we're healing along and then I go break, they just go psh. So it's just context for them. Initially, they might go, do you have food? Oh, you don't have food. Oh, you kept moving. Okay. And so it just takes a while for them to figure out the context of what does break mean in this situation.
Yeah, I think we often underestimate our dog's abilities to contextualize things in that way. And dogs are incredibly good at contextualizing things, which is also why we have to spend energy on generalization. Yes. And, you know, like, for instance, I know very talented clicker trainers who, like, for a lot of us folks that use verbal markers, we might have one marker that means like, stay there, I'm going to bring the treat or the toy to you. And then a different one that means come get the food from me. I know a lot of clicker trainers where for their dog, it's totally context. It's like, they know that when they're up on a platform that if I hear click, stay here, the food's coming to me, versus if I'm doing like a send away and I hear the click, like come back and get the reward. Like they understand the context of that. But you can also get as fancy with release words as you want to. Release words are kind of cool, and you can definitely have different words that mean different things to your dogs. In fact, my friend Forrest Mickey, he has like, Forrest. Oh, he's a really cool guy. You'll like him a lot, actually. You guys will get along. He has like half a dozen release cues that all they all tell the dog something about where the reward can be accessed. So they're all released to a reward. But for instance, he has a release cue that means I'm going to toss the reward in front of me, a different cue that means it's going to come like it's going to come down from me, a different one that means it's going to be like if the dog's on his left, the dog has to go behind his back to the right to get it. And he uses all these because he uses the placement of the reward to also shape, like fine tune precision. So it's getting a little bit advanced for probably a lot of our viewers and listeners. But the point is simply that you can be creative. So if you're confused or it just feels uncomfortable for you for whatever reason to use the same cue, you know, for the different things, then use two different cues. It's totally fine. You can have, like, I used to use break meant, you know, you're free, but like don't expect anything interesting to happen. And yes is release, and I'm going to throw a ball or going to give you food or whatever. Sort of, and so I could use break in situations where I wanted to release my dog but didn't want to spike arousal. The other thing that I did, and this one's kind of interesting, and I don't know that I've heard anybody else do it in this way, but you know, Lobo, my Malinois that I had, for him and for many of these high drive dogs, releasing to freedom is quite exciting. So even if you're not doing a game or play or a treat, if they're in a down or on place and you say break, it's just triggers excitement, right? Woohoo!
Dogs that like to run around and smell really like this. Yeah,
exactly. And so there are times with him where I wanted to release him and I really wanted to have as much probability of keeping excitement low as I could. And I had a cue where if I was playing with him, like playing tog or playing ball, when I say all done, it means the game is over. And what I've noticed was I could be playing balls and maybe bringing the ball back and he's all pumped up and his tail's high and his ears are alert. Yeah. And I go, all done. And he just goes, and like just immediately kind of deflates and then goes over and like sniffs around and pees on a tree and does all these like lower arousal behaviors. So when I noticed that, I started going, when I'm in these situations where it is, you know, more important than usual that he stays low arousal. If he was in a down, I would go, all done. And he would go, okay, so that means we're done doing this activity, but also don't expect anything cool to happen.
Yeah.
And I would notice that he would get up from his down like, all right, so now what are we doing? Is this something I should sniff? It just created a different thing. So you can, there are ways to actually shape release cues that are tied to a reduction of arousal.
And did just you like do that? Did you teach? Did you teach Lobo that by just saying that calmly and just walking off?
Oh yeah, exactly. Just from the from day one, every time we played, let's say we're playing tug. Yeah. A lot of times, you know, we say out, he drops it. Yes, come back and get it. Out, yeah. Yes, out, yes. And then eventually it's like out. And then we go, all done. And I just put the tug on a shelf and I kind of walk away.
Yeah. I do that with Vega.
It proceeds. Yeah.
And mine is because I'm an East Coaster. I go, go on. And then it's over.
Yeah.
That's what my mother would do to me. Okay. Go on. Yeah.
Yep. So then like using that then to release your dog out of position, you know, you can, you know, I think if you did it too much comparative to using it to say like plays over again, like, you know, any other form of conditioning, we could sort of reverse the effect, but there's not that many situations like, you know, like you've mentioned a few times today, like, does this really matter? There aren't that many situations where it's like imperative that my dog stays as low arousal as possible when I release them. That shouldn't be the majority of the time that I'm releasing my dog, because otherwise it's like I'm probably putting my dog in situations that maybe it's not the best situation for my dog to be in. If I got to be like, listen,
or
like,
expectations,
you can hang, but like, dog, you got to be chill or shit's going to hit the fan here. Yeah. Right. So
you can tug this bite sleeve, but be relaxed about it. Yeah. No.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And like,
an important thing is like, guys, when you're thinking about dog training, and the thing that I love about Consider the Dog is, and I've mentioned this in our first live when we thought we ended, it was the very first live Q&A ever, and we thought it ended. And Tyler and I were talking for another 15 minutes, which you guys got to see and thought was hilarious. I think we should just incorporate that into the ring. Okay, goodbye, everyone. And then start talking. And no, we didn't talk shit about anyone or any of the questions. That's not us. And so you can go back and watch. It's in the recording. But I said to Tyler, I was like, do you ever get worried about like the responses that other trainers are going to come out with? Because And Tyler said, no, like, obviously, like, everyone's vet. It doesn't mean he said, I don't necessarily agree with everyone's thing all the time, but there's no one exact way of doing everything. And that's the really cool thing about dog training. I think that's what everybody loves about dog training so much is like, what's he going to say? What's she going to do? What's right? And because it's going to be, that's why it's so important to get a wide tool belt, a lot of variety in the kind of training. Like, a lot of people will shit talk clicker trainers, but I think they're some of the best dog trainers in the world. You know, when you can mark behavior and free shape and do all that other stuff, but equally, you know, the opposite kind of trend, there's going to be something that you're going to pull from that. So when you hear Tyler say something about a release and you hear me say something about a release that either is the complete opposite or you think is the complete opposite, just stop and ask yourself, do a little bit of analytical work of like, okay, when would I use this one? And when would I use this one? Right. Or do I want to use neither of them and make up my own thing? Right. So I think it's important to realize that there's variety. And just like Tyler's like, I wouldn't go to the end of the leash on like that on this. I'd be going like, that's okay. And it might be the exact thing to do in that situation. Or you might go, this isn't working. Let's try the other thing. And right, it's about that variety and just saying, I don't know, but I'm going to try and figure it out and doing a little bit of brain work throughout the process.
Yeah, I think, you know, any individual technique that any trainer does too is always part of a larger sort of like ecosystem. And so somebody might do something different than me. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. It's like what they're doing is right for them and their sort of ecosystem of how they approach things, and what I'm doing is really right for me and my sort of ecosystem. I mean, there are some things that are like just blatantly like, don't do that. Right. Yeah, like don't hold your dog's head in the toilet bowl and flush it. You know,
right. That would be,
I did that to my little cousin once when I was a kid. It did not end well for me.
Swirly, sir.
She dragged me up the stairs by my earlobes. It was not fun. Anyway,
rightfully so.
But yeah, I mean, I think keeping an open mind is good, and there's no holy grail. There is just no holy grail. So like Evan said, keep yourselves broad, explore different instructors, but you like give things enough time too. I think that's one of the things right now. There's such an abundance of information out there that I think it can be overwhelming for people, and they can bounce from, I just learned, you know, Evan's style last week, and now I'm going to go to a Tyler Mudo workshop, and now I'm going to go to a J-Jack workshop, and now I'm going to go to, and it's like, you can just be like, I don't know which way is left and which way is right. And I think for me, you know, And again, for you, like when we were starting out, like Facebook wasn't really what it is today. Like YouTube wasn't really what it is today. There weren't as many seminars to go to. You didn't really hear about the seminars very easily. And so you might get to a seminar or you might get the opportunity to learn from somebody. And that might happen like once a year or once every 6 months. And you have a lot of time to like sit with that material and experiment with it and feel it out and then discard what's not really working within your whole system and then keep what is really working well. And that was one of the benefits of when the information was a little bit more scarce. So I sometimes get jealous of, you know, people learning how to train dogs now because it's so easy. Like people are training dogs for 2 years that are doing what took me like 7 years to figure out. But at the same time, I do think that there's some information overload. So yeah, you're going to hear conflicting things from different people, but like find something that seems to resonate with you and then just like stick it out and like recognize with anything that you do in the beginning, whatever you choose, when you say, I really like the way Evan presents himself, I'm going to go with him. I'm going to try his style of things. Like also prepare yourself for the fact that Evan's style of things may be great. You're probably going to suck at it in the beginning. And so what a lot of people do is they try a new style. They suck at it in the beginning because it's new to them. And then they go, This doesn't work for me. I got to try something else.
Everyone says that about video, right? They're like, oh, you're your best version of your, well, I don't know if they say your best version. That might be a bit of an insult, but you're great on video. You love video, whatever. Do you know how many takes I still do to put out one video? I love video doing now. You're right. I absolutely love it. But I would sit there and drill. I have thousands of videos on Facebook. I don't know if it's 3,000 or 4,000 videos on Facebook. And a lot of those for the first 3 years, I'd sit in front of my whiteboard, I'd have my, or a mirror and have it point form. And I would do 30 to 50 takes. They'd do one stupid little video about how to get your dog to sit. And it's that repetition. It's the, what is it? 4,000, 10,000 hours, whatever it is. To be an expert at something. That's a lot of repetitions of like, how do I get my dog to lay down on concrete that doesn't want to do it? Well, you got to try something a lot of reps. You got to do things a lot of times. It's good to not be good at something because it means that you're going to grow, you're going to learn, you're going to improve. If there's any book, if you guys are into audiobooks, that I would highly recommend reading or listening to rather right now is Kevin Hart's I Can't Make This Up. You want to talk about struggle, you want to talk about perseverance. Man, Kevin Hart is the world champion of perseverance. Yeah, and jokes.
In the meantime, if you guys have follow-up questions, join us in the members Facebook group, and we'll catch you next time around.
Thanks, guys. Bye, meow.
That's it for today, folks. Be sure to tune in next time when Brian Agnew will be back. We'll see you then.